My name is Donlin Washington. I was asked to pretty much break down the comic book page and dissect the jargon. You know, every language has their own codes and jargons and dialects within them. Same thing that goes at every profession. The same thing goes with the comic book era and the comic book genre. And I wanted to, you know, I started researching and started delving into it. It's really interesting. And one of the things that we are looking at, essentially, are different elements on a comic book page. And what those elements entail. I mean, here we have Captain America, death to the doers of democracy, and there's this whole scene, and you have panels and spaces in between, and you have bubbles and spreads, and everything is going on. But what do they all mean? How do they all connect, right? So, essentially, we come to examples. This is old school jargon, things that we know from way back, or what we're used to seeing when we look at a comic or pick up a comic, any type, whether it's a graphic novel or an Archie comic, okay? So balloons, most notably aligned with the comic book genre, they actually have a long-established history that date back to 900 AD, which I thought was fascinating. I was like, okay, yeah. So not much has changed in design. However, balloons drive a storyline and give the writer options as to how to have their characters interact with the reader, okay? Whether it be including the reader or having us be voyeurs to the unfolding action. Most notably, when Thor uses his hammer, you'll see crack-a-boom, right? And as a way to illustrate an emotion or some kind of dramatic action. Okay? So, yeah, balloons. Ah, example of a panel. Panels are, they're also well-established. As an element in the comic book world. A panel may be a series of visuals, like in the previous slide, or on one page, or one poster-like pose. Take, for example, Justice League. Okay? There was a comic that I had read a long time ago, The X-Men, and it was used in the 90s a lot, and some may say overused, by some artists like Jim Lee, where you had a lot of poster-sized stars, they're individually within the teams. And they were great, but there was this one time where they were trying to get information. And Psylocke, she has these side blades. And she takes the guy out. And at the end, she's like this upward pose and looking all, you know, I just beat this guy. And there's this off balloon. And the balloon says, nice pose, Psylocke, but we need information from the guy. Now he's unconscious. But still, without that balloon and that action, if you just have the action by itself, it's just a poster of a cool-looking chick who just defeated this guy. But with the balloon, it gives content and connection to the action that's actually taking place. Okay? Panels can also be a great way to let audiences know the relationship between characters or who's new on a roster like the Avengers. There's this ever-shifting, ever-changing roster. So when you have a panel, you know, it's the Justice League, right? You wouldn't think that Plastic Man in the upper corner would be associated with Batman. Yet, you know, you have three detectives, Batman, Plastic Man, forgot this guy's other name, Mr. Fantastic, I can't remember his name, but he's another plastic guy, electro guy, something like that. These three are detectives. You have Outworld, Otherworld, with Green Lantern, Hawkman, and Superman. You have mythological characters, Flash, Mercury, can we talk about that, Black Canary, Wonder Woman. And then you have the Eternal Outsiders, with Martian Manhunter. And look at this guy over here. He's Red Tornado. You can honestly forget. But depending on how you read the panel, it can tell its story in and of itself. The associations with the roster, how they interact. You also notice that here's the big three, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. They're bigger than everybody else in the panel. And here you have down here, here's Adam in this chair, chilling. We don't know what his, I guess, basic all function is in Justice League, But telling from this panel, he's important enough for at least to be not lost in the scene with everybody else. He still needs to be visualized, which is an important thing. So panels in and of themselves, they can really tell a story even right there, and you can create whatever you want from there, right? A panel or a planche, the French term that denotes the total design unit, rather than a typical page on which it was printed, right, can also, sorry, I didn't know this, I'm going to cut it off, right, it can also suggest that there is no right way to read a page. You can have several different layers in which you're going to read this scene, right, depending, you don't even have to know who the other characters are. Just by seeing the big three, you have an idea already. It's already DC in that sense, right? And then some people might not even see this down here, Justice League America, that's on the table in and of itself. They might overlook everything else. They might overlook that because there's so much going on. Where's my eye going to focus? Ah, a spread. A spread can tell a story in a series of panels, okay? Notice the shapes. There's so much we can grasp as a reader where our eyes are supposed to be, right? Or where they're supposed to go. More importantly, the way the artwork is spread out, the control is all on the writer and the artist, right? You have to read it the way they've done it. You can't put your eye over here. It has to be here first. You have to read it as the writer and artist intended for you to read it. Okay? You're, in a sense, being manipulated into reading that spread the way the artist intended. It's subtle, but there are subversive elements surrounding how we as readers are being taught to view the world from a different perspective. Right? So I thought that was interesting, too. And the shapes are also unusual. Still, it says you must read this first. There has to be a sequential pattern. Where in the previous panel, you read it any way you want. There's no wrong way to read it. Mm-hmm. So there's diversity and flexibility in studying graphic novels, even from the visual alone. Ah, splash pages. Splash pages are commonly used to grab the reader, and they're usually pulled over. It's most commonly used over two pages introduces the comic, right? A splash page may also involve a considerable amount of action. There's some things going on here, but we don't quite sure know what, right? At times, splash pages were in the middle of a comic, so you can use it as a poster. And some magazines like The Wizard Guide would also have it as a poster-sized version. So you can, like, pull it out and, like, frame it, put it on your wall and stuff. And they were really cool. And they would have special promotions. But consider this splash page. Think of how we could use it as a teaching tool in our classrooms. Judging from this splash page, what may our students infer about the story? Right? I was talking with some friends the other day, and I said, well, we know it's Watchmen, and we knew what Watchmen was. But if we were to give it to someone who doesn't know the backstory or the history, what would they know this is a smiley face with a blood stain on it? They might not. They might predict something different. Or they might see it's like a jelly stain. You know, they might not quite know, because all they see is Watchmen, this scene, and this scene over here. So predicting, what can we have our students predict about the oncoming action or what's to come? In that sense. Right? Ah, gutter panels, reading between the lines. Gutters are essentially, they are in between each panel. Some artists like Jack Kirby would even blur these lines. He would have characters come out of the page. But essentially, it's a standard, right? And some of the space in between it's still another way of telling the story based on how you can manipulate those spaces in between them in of themselves, right? So it's, in a sense, reading between the lines as well. What's on the page, we don't have to take for granted, as we have to just accept it. And I think that's what Kirby did as well, by making these big, overgrown, larger-than-life characters and have them, like, blur those lines in between. Okay. A tear. Well, think of like a wedding cake. They're tears. They're levels. And they're most commonly used in the forms of rows or panels in a sequential sequence. And they're another way of telling the story. Like in the previous, in panel 5, you had those weird octagon-type shapes. And here is another way of telling the reader, I want you to read it this way. I want you to read from beginning to end. Or I want you to read from side to side. Or diagonally. I'm sort of telling you how I want you to look at the story. Okay. Ah, splatterpunk. Splatterpunk is, it's one of those genres where people think it's new, but it's been around forever. It's a spin-off of the horror novel genre. And splatterpunk can be defined as being distinguished by its graphic, often gory depictions of violence. I have Marvel Zombies here because it's sort of like an off-world takeoff of the Marvel Universe where they can play around and do different things with it. Still, there's a gory, horror-type theme to the comics themselves. It improves the storyline in some ways. You can explore different ways how you would see Captain America or Thor. They're not in their usual or regiment or traditional roles. You can take them out and explore them more. The illustrations are often disturbing. Okay. It's also been noted that splatterpunk began in the late 1980s. However, before the codes, and that's like pre-1955, roughly around there, that were enforced for comics, writers and artists were pushing the envelope with gore and violence in their comics. That was when Batman brandished a gun in his covers of his comic books. Long before, now we know Batman never carrying a gun. He refuses to, because what happened to his parents. But in his early days, he had a gun. Yeah, Batman and Robin on the cover of Action Comics, he was brandishing a gun. Nothing is new. Everything is basically the same as it ever was. Impact of the elements in a comic book, right? Elements to splatterpunk and the structure of comics today could be a result of reaction to the industry itself in the mid-1950s. According to Demanding Respect, The Evolution of an American Comic, the Comics Code of 1955 marked the end of the early industrial age of the American comic book, where the representation of these images were being accused of corrupting America's youth. Right? Coupled with the Cold War and the accusation of causing juvenile delinquency, writers, artists, and others in the comic book industry were forced to become inventive. In doing this, the comic book as a literary genre and its elements have been taken as an important literary narrative form. What's more, in Hilary Shute's review of several works on comic book terminology, she refers to the last essay in The Language of Comics, where Gene Kannenberg Jr. argues that in Chris Ware's meticulous, intricate design, heavy work, text reads as an image, that the page itself becomes a visual literary totality. In other words, the elements of a comic book continues to be studied and explored. I found that it's still not as explored as it could be. They still talk about the narrative more than the physical representation of the comic books themselves, which is equally as important because we're dealing with an art form that is working with both pictures and the words themselves. So in some cases, we don't have enough of what this jargon and how it contributes to the literary genre of comic book writing. Okay. Comics in motion. My love-hate relationship with these. I like motion comics. I like what they try to do. But there's a lot of hit and miss that's going on. They've attempted to take on what's on the printed page to film with mixed results. The Thor and Loki, Blood Brothers, it works in some instances because of Esad Ribic's artwork, which strengthens the visual of the motion comic, but the direction, the voice acting, it's wanting. It lacks. In Spider-Woman, they literally took whatever was on the page and slapped it right on in a motion comic. Think about the old-time cartoons in the 1960s with Captain America and the Hulk, and they had, like, really stiff, like, stick figure images, and, like, the same actor had four different roles in the same, like, five-minute cartoon, and it was, yeah, it's on a similar level with that. It doesn't work at all. This Marvel Knight Spider-Woman. And what happens here...
Shout Factory TV, changing the channel.
How the hell are we supposed to find him now?
He's right. Could be anyone in the crowd. Is that how...
Yes.
Where'd you get it?
Santa.
Can he get me one, too?
Please, everyone! Guys, I'm having a hard time tracking in all this.
You know, it's very stilted.
If any of you are Skrulls, please raise your hand. Thank you!
Please step back and let us do what we came here to do. Move!
Guys!
Walk away from here, or I will kill all these humans.
Actually, I've got a better idea.
When you look at it, I mean, how is that supposed to, as a consumer, or a studier of the comics, how is that supposed to work compared to reading it on the page? Right? It's distracting, because Captain America sounds just like Wolverine. And you're like, they don't sound alike. In real life. In animations and in films, yeah. They don't. You know, Hugh Jackman and Chris Evans do not sound alike. Yeah. So when you're reading reading a comic in and of itself, you're the voice in the head, basically. And what you're doing is, in a sense, you're controlling the action. You may laugh at an inappropriate moment. You may pause. You may start being upset. But in a sense, how you read what's going on is more in your control. With a motion comic, they attempt to do that for you with very, very limited results. Some comics, it works. Spider-Woman, it doesn't. The less characters I found in this limited series, when they had one or two voice actors, it was fine. But if you notice, there are five here, and three of them have the same voice. So it's very distracting, and you miss all the other elements. They're supposed to be hunting Skrulls, and you don't know where they're hunting them. Everyone looks the same. Panels look muddied, and the background is not distinct. Whereas in the comic in and of itself, it's a lot more distinction. Things are clear. The panels are there for you to follow the action. Whereas here, you're forced to see it from one viewpoint. And it can be very distracting. Okay, the Eternals. Originally created by Jack Kirby in the 1970s, the Eternals have been just outside the framework of the Marvel Universe. And the reason why I have this is because their motion comic works in a clearer way than Spider-Woman. Unfortunately, they wouldn't allow me to. There's the trailer that I could fit into here, but still, I have the visual of what's on the page for the most part in the motion comic, Neil Gaiman's version of the Eternals, with John Romita Jr. doing the artwork. They use the same artwork in the motion comic, and it works because it's so larger than life. It's big. It's taking up a whole page, and you have the words and motion, in a sense, they work more fluidly. They're a bit more, they work together a bit more than Spider-Woman does. Right? So it does work in this case. Thor and Loki Blood Brothers, they used Asad Ribic's
Shout Factory artwork. TV, changing the channel.
Let none who values his life dare disturb my solitude.
What of one who values not life, but death, Lord of Asgard? Might she be granted audience?
I bid you welcome, Hela.
You are wise to show me courtesy, Loki Laufeysen. We may be monarchs both. With a touch of my hand, I can yet render you my subject.
Notice the artwork. It really helps with the comic itself.
Though you can provide me with what other nourishment I crave.
Alas, the conqueror becomes indeed a petty paymaster. But never mind. What token can I provide you?
The immortal soul.
It works better because there are limited characters. There's only a couple of voices. But the artwork with the motion comic is really what helps this to shine. Whereas with Spider-Woman again, poor Spider-Woman, or even the Inhumans, there are mixed results because they're not making adjustments for literally comics in motion. What they're doing is you're just slapping it right on there and saying, well, here it is. The exact same dialogue, the exact same everything. Which, it's still mixed. It has a way to go.
Are some of those scenes that were in there, are they also on the comic page? Like even like the close-up of his face and things like that?
Yeah. They're there, but they're in panels.
Right.
And it's stronger because if you notice in... here, this is one of the scenes from the comic in and of itself. And from previously, I don't want to overshoot. When you're looking here, it's also from the comic. It's one of the covers because it was a four-part limited series. Mm-hmm. Here you see he is in control. It's hard to capture this type of moment in a motion comic because he looks majestic, Loki. He's commanding, and he's finally done it. He's the king of Asgard. He's won. And it's there. But in the motion comic, when you hear his voice, you don't equate the voice to Ribid's artwork. In a sense, I always thought his voice was deeper. A bit more, I guess more like Tom Hiddleston. Mm-hmm. You know, and this actor who's doing the voice, he's trying. Mm-hmm. But I don't hear Loki when I see this this motion comic. But most of the artwork, it's there in panels. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of poster size moments in that limited series as well. The artwork really shines. There's very little dialogue. And at least in the first two comics, it's closer, there's more dialogue closer in the end, but the artwork really shines. And it's tough to translate that in a film form when you don't have a lot of dialogue. It's really basically Loki in that first installment, and he's like, I've done it. You see Thor, he's in a prison cell, and he's pretty much chained up, and then you see, you know, basically his enemies are all imprisoned, and you see Loki walking through, and it's panel to panel, and then you see that he makes eye contact with Thor, and they don't have to say anything, but you know that at the end of this limited series, that Loki's going to lose again, and that Thor will be triumphant, just by that look they have between them. Like, you keep doing this, but you keep, you know, mm-hmm. you keep failing. And you'll fail again. I'm just going to sit here and wait, pretty much. So it's tough. And while here you can see all of it, its majesty and everything with Loki, in the motion comic, I find that it loses some translation of just what it means for Loki to finally have won. To finally be king of Asgard, because you see him being subjugated by Hela, essentially, and that's really not something that in a motion comic, the history, you can see it in the image, but it's distracting when you hear the voices, because you don't think the Queen of Hell is going to have that kind of voice. That's kind of nasally. It's all right, but it should be deep and dramatic. And I always think of maybe Helen Mirren, mm-hmm. or a deep English accent, or Cate Blanchett with her Australian accent. Something that commands and that will demand someone to listen to what I'm saying. If she were to speak, I would just keep walking. I'm like, oh, okay, you're the Queen of Hell. Bye. I'll see you. But that's what we as readers do. We can infer those voices. Whereas in a motion comic, you know, it really depends on who they get. It works with the Inhumans because Black Bolt, one of the characters, doesn't speak. Mm-hmm. So there is no voice actor for him, which is great. And he's drawn very well. Mm-hmm. So his movements are of a king, so that's great. But not every comic has a character who doesn't speak. For the most part, people, like, could you imagine having a motion comic Spider-Man, and the actor for him has to be really incredible? We have so many examples of who Spidey is that if you get casting for a bad voice for Spider-Man, your whole motion comic, that's it. They haven't made one, I don't think, yet, with Spider-Man as a lead. Yeah. He's been in, like, mm-hmm. parts like this, like very small, tiny parts mm-hmm. in other motion comics, but he hasn't had his own yet. And I think that's one of the reasons, is because the voice is very important. Mm-hmm. There are too many moving parts that have to work with a motion comic. Whereas the Spider-Woman miniseries was very successful, the motion comic didn't do as well. They only really take really successful series and put them in a motion comic because they want those similar results. But so far, some work, some don't, because of that. But yeah, for the most part, I remember buying the original series of Thor and Loki Blood Brothers.
I think most people would probably rather watch an original animated series than a
motion comic. Motion comic, yeah. I mean, the thing is that it has a long history, but not much has improved, which is a real problem. You would think because of technology and CGI, all the things that we have that are better than the 1950s and 60s, that they would improve and they would work. They don't work as well still, for whatever reason. Right? So why does comic book jargon matter? Okay. Perhaps because definition of jargon as the language used for a particular activity or by a particular group of people is why, as an educator, comic books are so important. It is, in essence, a language I have taken for granted. The first place I read anything from Shakespeare was in an X-Men, Uncanny X-Men comic. And it was there in the lower right-hand corner of a panel. And you saw it was the entrance to the school, Xavier School for Gifted Youngsters. Right there, Gray Malkin Lane was all there. And there were three lines of King Lear. I must have been maybe seven, eight years old when I read it. Did I understand it at the time? No, I read it. I kept it moving. But years later, when I read King Lear, I understood it, the play. Not because I had this great professor. I didn't. But because the words, I connected them back to that comic that I had read. I understood what was going on in X-Men. But maybe I didn't know what King Lear was from. But it was there that it belonged. Like, it just was right there on the page. Like, it had every right to be there. I can be in a comic book. Why not? People can recite from Shakespeare all the time. Why can't it be in a comic book? Yeah, Professor Xavier, he's running a school. Why can't Shakespeare be there? Why can't King Lear be there? So it helps me make connections, essentially. Right? That's what comics and graphic novels do. Help us understand things and give us a reference point we may not have had before. Isn't that what we try to do with our students, essentially, is to help them make those types of connections? It is so important that our students see that being in a classroom doesn't have to be boring, and that we can utilize things in their everyday world to help them connect to what's going on in the classroom. And I think, yeah, the reason why I wear the Green Lantern shirt and wear the Green Lantern ring, and I have, they're like, oh, you like Green Lantern? Yeah. Oh, let's talk about Green Lantern. I have no problem with that. I will find some way to connect it back to what we're doing. And they're like, oh, man, you tricked us. Yeah. We're still in school. It's all right. But essentially, what graphic novels do, learning the jargon is a way, in a sense, of learning another type of language. And a way of learning, a way to relating to the world. And if we know this type of language, we can learn other types of languages. And they're not so foreign or far apart from us. Every profession, even in that classroom, we have a lingo after a while, depending on what we've studied or what we've taught in that classroom. They know words that maybe another classroom, they haven't even touched or addressed. So that's a great thing for a classroom to have their own language. So why can't we learn and work with languages that are in a comic book? Panels and spreads and balloons, we take those things for granted because we're in it. We're entrenched in it. We read it, we understand it, we keep it moving. But for someone who, in a sense, maybe try and move the page around and look at it and see from a different angle, what are we looking at here? What things that we are taking for granted, how can we help our students figure things out? Another way of looking at something. Okay. So, I think I have one more slide. Right. Essentially, I outlined a lesson plan. I don't usually use it this way, but I will take a comic, and I'll make a copy of it, and usually I'll do it black and white because the color is expensive. And I'll bring it to class and I'll hand it out and I'll put on right on the board, give me predictions. What do you think happened before this page? What do you think happened after? And they'll usually come up with some really wild stuff, weird, crazy things. These have nothing to do with what actually happened, but it's great to see where their mind is going. I like to pick something very obscure that you have to have read what was going on before to know what's happening. Mm-hmm. So the predictions, I won't have a set of what they should write. They should really come from them, whatever it is. And then when they want to know what it is, I'll pull out the whole comic, and they're like, oh, usually what they have is a lot more interesting than what's on the page. I like to pick Daredevil because Mark Waid, at the time, like his run, there's splash pages. There's bubbles, there's spreads, there's balloons. He uses everything. There's panels, there's weird shapes. So in one comic, I can pick two pages or one page, and most of what's in the presentation is on that page. So I can say, okay, well, you know, predict for me. What do you think happened before? Who do you think these people are in this page in and of itself? What's happening here? And then, you know, they'll write down stuff down, and then we'll come back as a class, and I'll write it on the board, and we'll discuss and predict, and they don't have to be wrong. I think a lot of the times what happens with our students is that this whole thing about, is it right? Did I get it right? Is it correct? When you're predicting, you don't have to get anything right yet. You're just figuring out what may happen or what may have happened before. You don't have to be correct. You don't have to be right. And it scares them because they feel like if I'm not right, then maybe I'm not smart. And I'm like, no. Nothing to do with that. We're just trying to figure out what's going on in this scene by what happened before. We're not, you know, nothing has to be right or wrong here. And it's a very scary place for them because if there's no right or wrong or there's no definitive answer, you know, if there's no A, B, if B is not the answer, then what do I do? And the thing is that for our students, it's okay not to have that known thing right away. They can have an unknown factor in that moment, and it'll be okay. And they can take off from there and then have a definitive answer later that with less work on the other end of it. Because if you start to prepare initially, it'll be less. And you'll have less frustration. You'll know what it's not, which is a lot of process of elimination can also be a way of predicting and answering questions and focusing not just on the essays that we write for them, but on multiple choice too. I know that's not the right answer. That can't be right. So you eliminate that. Okay, great. Now you got three possible choices to work with. So it's another way of, I guess in a sense, using skills they already may have, just in a different way. And I think that's what helps learning another way of language and of jargon in that sense. And that is my presentation.